Life Audio.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Ramp Podcast. I am Ted Klug, joined as always in studio by my good friend, my partner in radio, Barnabas Piper. Pipe runs just doing that small town pastor work, meaning that he's in Portland for the week. Probably taking some meetings with Harvest House, you think? Some exciting new Harvest House business in the works?
It's possible. I mean, when a small town guy goes to the big city, you never know what's going to happen. Hijinks ensue. It's a little overwhelming. I've been to Portland. It's an exceptionally weird city. And I have to imagine that's just shocking to his small town sensibilities.
He's just
pearl clutching and horrified at all of the debauchery going on around him.
Yeah, kind of a Mr. Smith goes to Washington vibe. You know, just that he's probably wearing overalls and just being that humble small town guy, completely overwhelmed by what he's seeing. Yeah. So
trying to figure out why his corn cob pipe smells like tobacco and everybody else's smells like another plant.
Exactly. Shout out Ronald, just doing the Lord's work out there. God bless that kid. Thoughts and prayers. Hopefully he gets that next book deal from Harvest House. We'll see how it goes for him. But Piper, we are here in the studio doing our radio program, as we always do. And I have a question for you, and it's related to birthdays in middle age. And we'll get to that right after this quick break. All right, Pipe. So, full disclosure, we're taping this on March 15. Today is my birthday, and I turned 47 today. And I feel like for the last decade or so, my only expectation for my birthday has been to try to navigate through the day unscathed, meaning not even to have a good day, but just to not have a bad day. And as bad luck, providence, whatever we're calling it, would have it, this week has just been a gut punch. Like, bad news on Monday, bad news on Tuesday. I shudder to think what will happen today on my actual birthday. My question to you is, what are your expectations like for birthdays, like in this stage of life?
Oh, man. So I turned 40 at the end of the month. So I'm coming up on, I mean, statistically, I'm on the front end of middle aged right now. I think 40 is like, you are like, it is the half life of life, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah. But 40 is a weird one because there's all these massive, like, oh, are you doing anything big? And I'm like, why, to celebrate that my life is half over? I don't totally follow here. I basically, my preference would be to go through life pretending that birthdays don't exist.
Mm.
You know,
talk about that.
They're not different than any other day. You know, it completes an arbitrary measurement of time, saying you've arrived. But every day does that. Like, you know, just depending on where your starting point is, and so it doesn't feel to me like an accomplishment or or, you know, anything. Like, I understand why my wife wants to celebrate my birthday.
Mm.
That kind of makes sense to me. Why should I want to celebrate my birthday is the question. And I don't have a good answer to that. So I don't feel negative towards them. I kind of don't feel anything towards them. And when you don't feel anything towards something, it's really hard to get sort of excited and geeked up about it.
Yeah, I would say I'm with you. I don't think I feel anything either. Other than just kind of a vague sense of, I don't want anything bad to happen, you know? And if something bad does happen, I feel kind of ripped off by it. As the years go by, I'm realizing how fundamentally a ridiculous position that is, you know? Because to your point, the day is no different. Now, what would move the needle to me is, if by some like stroke of legislation or whatever, you're allowed to stay home from work on your birthday. Like, if you can just kind of disconnect from work and it's understood that this is what everybody does, I think that would make it feel like a birthday. Or at least like improve the chances of having a good day. But I mean, nobody really goes to work anymore anyway. I mean, half the country is like working from their pajamas. So maybe this isn't even a category that's worth talking about. But
yeah, well, let's expand that category. Yeah. What's a birthday perk that would be worth it for an adult? Because yeah, like, I mean, I have enough flexibility in what I do. You know, I work at a church, and so like I don't have 9-to-5 office hours. You're sort of constantly on, but you can step away if you need to. So like not doing something on my birthday for work is relatively easy, unless it's like a Sunday. And so what is the perk that goes, okay, like that's nice. Is it an additional vacation day you get to claim at your leisure? Is it money? It's certainly not like, hey, everybody gather around in the break room and we're going to have cupcakes. Like that is the opposite of a birthday celebration to me. That's just ruination of work, which I enjoy, and forced fun, which I hate. So no, thank you.
And it's one of those like forced chit chat moments, you know, because when you're in that break room, as long as you're in there, you're doing like, how was your week? How's work? You know, you're getting that grade of chit chat in, which is
all the questions that nobody actually cares about the answers to.
Yeah, exactly. Dude, maybe I have a less ridiculous one and a more ridiculous one. Maybe on your birthday, just like, I don't know, 1 to 3 people pay you a compliment. Like if that happened today, I would be delighted. You know, just like 2 or 3 people saying something nice about you. Like, I'll take that. That's a nice little birthday perk. Or maybe whatever the most unpleasant part of your like work life is, you get to not do that for a day.
I like, or you get like a hall pass on that stuff for whatever day you don't want to do it. Cause like, this year, my birthday falls on a Friday, which is my day off, generally speaking. And so I would like to take that perk and throw it down on like a Tuesday, which is a heavy meeting day, and go, I don't want to talk about budgets today. I'm using my birthday hall pass.
Yeah, no, I like that. I like that a lot. Yeah, some kind of birthday vocational hall pass to get out of an unpleasant thing. That would be solid, dude. That'd be really solid. And then maybe the person or two paying you a compliment, that would feel really delightful.
Yeah.
So there it is,
but
man.
Not in a public way. Not like where it's like in front of everybody, just like a conversation where they speak kind words to you and lift you up a little bit.
Yeah. Like, hey, you know, I really appreciate your whatever. That'd be amazing, dude. Oh, by the way, that reminds me, when we get off the air, I've got a hilarious publishing story to tell you. It was part of the gut punch that has been this week, but you'll find it humorous, but I can't tell it on the air.
I look forward to hearing it. I have one other birthday question. So, you know, my kids are teenagers now. Teenagers, when it comes to gift giving, are not great at it because they tend to think about what they would want, not what somebody else would want.
Yeah.
And B, they just live in an entirely different reality space than adults. And so for me, getting the same thing for my birthday every year is great, you know?
Yeah.
Something like if I got like a bottle of bourbon that I enjoy and tickets to a baseball game, although baseball game tends to be more Father's Day.
Yeah.
I was just like, I never have to wonder what I'm going to get. I just know it's this and this. I would be thrilled.
Dude, that actually sounds perfect. Yeah. That sounds really amazing.
My kids are horrified at that idea.
All right, because they want to be creative. They want to stretch their legs a little bit.
That's boring, and I'm like, no, creativity is where you make mistakes.
That's right.
And also, I don't need anything. Not because I'm wealthy, but because like I'm just content. I don't need no new toys. You know, they can't afford the stuff that I do want. You know, like I want a new Blackstone griddle. But those are a good ones, you know, somewhere between $300 and like $800. My kids can't buy that for me. So, I'm just like, go in together and I would take a Twins hat every year. I would take baseball tickets every year. I would take a bottle of bourbon, which, you know, they would need to get some help to purchase. Sure. And they're like, oh, that sucks. And then they throw out all these ideas, and I'm like, oh, I hate all of those ideas. I don't want any of those things you just suggested. You know, gift cards to this new hip clothing store. No, 100% no, not doing it. That's Ronnie's right. gift. Right. So yeah, how do you, what is your stance towards gifts as a middle-aged man?
Yeah, it's funny, man. Like, and I say this with all due affection and regard for my two boys, and they're boys, you know, so I think the calculus is a little different for boys. They probably remember my birthday 30% of the time. So like, I saw Maxim this morning. Maxim's a sophomore in high school, and he's a delightful guy. I know that he loves me. I know it beyond, he would lay down his life for me, truly. But like, you know, he navigated through the morning with me completely unaware that it was my birthday, which is fine. And I'm having lunch with Tristan today. I always, every Wednesday we work out and we get lunch together, and he may or may not remember, but it's funny. Like I with both of them, again, I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that they really care for me. But I just think in the world of guys, and I'm like this too, like, I don't know my guy friends' birthdays. Like, I really don't, you know, but I think all my guy friends feel like, you know, I really care for them and like them. And, you know, so they don't question that, but like, I'm not sending like the happy birthday text to my guy buddies. Just because I don't know, and I really don't care. It's not something
and,
we talk
and
about.
And you don't expect them to remember or care, so it's all fair.
Exactly. Yeah. And that to me is one of the gifts of, I don't know, the kinds of friendships that we have where, you know, we just kind of talk about the things that we care about, and, you know, the birthday thing kind of goes by the wayside. So I would say regarding gift giving, my boys are both pretty good, and it usually falls into that, like, you know, twins hat. Sometimes they'll just get me like an NFL draft magazine and some candy, and I'm like, great, this is really fun, you know? That magazine costs like $12 off the rack, and I would have never done that for myself, but I'll enjoy flipping through it, you know?
Yeah, they just gave you like 3 hours of enjoyment, which is
totally
about like a baseball game.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. So I would say they do pretty good, and they know me really well. You know, they know what I enjoy and kind of what I like, and like Tristan's at an age now where like he'll get me a really nice cigar, you know, because we do the cigar room thing together, and you know, he'll smoke with me, and man, there's nothing better than that. Like an hour with my kids smoking a cigar, talking about life, like that's almost the greatest gift anyone could give me. So I would very much be down for stuff like that. But yeah, we'll see if he remembers. It'll be interesting. But no hard feelings if not. Pipe, let's take another break. And then I've got like a little coda to our millennial conversation from last week. One more thing to run by you. We'll be back after this quick break. All right, Pipe, we're back. We've kind of been doing this thing where we've been talking about generations or kind of groups of people. We talked about Gen Z a couple of weeks ago. We talked about millennials last week. I assume we'll talk about Gen X at some point. My question is...
In true Gen X fashion, we should just not talk about them. And yeah. That way they will all feel justified in being forgotten.
Yeah, we can be bitter and hurt about it, which is a core Gen X value, you know. Although Gen Xers and millennials get offended in different ways. Being offended is sort of the millennial's occupation. You're like punching the clock and doing 8 or 9 hours a day on that as a millennial. But like,
yeah.
Gen Xers, it's sort of, I don't know. It still happens, but it gets carried out differently. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's the difference between temper tantrum and pouting. Gen X pouts, millennials throw temper tantrums.
Yeah, and the temper tantrums are almost like part of the entertainment for them. You know, like if you're not getting offended by a show or a movie in some way, like it's almost not as fun as a millennial. But I feel like as a Gen Xer, you're kind of getting, you're getting indignant about different things. It's like life that make existential things make you indignant
I feel like Gen X by and large could just be summed up with like Eeyore. There's just sort of a like well, that happened again, you know, we get forgotten again. So it's not like it's not outrage offended. It's almost like just waiting for the other shoe to drop. And then when it drops or is perceived to drop, you're like, well, on brand. That's what we expected.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas the millennial, you're kind of like, you know, combing through the article that somebody sent for a way to become offended, or, you know, you're looking for the problematic thing in a show or a movie. And this is sort of the entertaining thing to talk about. I was talking about generational movies with two of my colleagues, actually three of my colleagues, two of whom are listeners. Shout out Rachel and Rebecca, who work in my office. They're professors at Union, and they love the show. And we were talking about this, and our third colleague, Chris, is a little older than me, and he indicated that for him, La La Land is sort of the emblematic millennial movie. So, and it was interesting in that the moment he said it, I agreed, but I hadn't thought of it previously. Like, where are you at on La La Land as a, like, millennial time capsule?
I don't know. I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but so I will say this, that is a movie that does not hold up. Once or twice I saw it, I loved the sort of experience of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, you rewatch a movie and you're kind of going for depth. You know, what's behind the flash? What's the substance behind the flash? And there's not a lot there. It's is a pretty depressing, shallow, meaningless worldview with that sort of, like, you know, I think you described it as self-conscious storytelling in the last episode, that idea of just sort of like very aware of stage in life and what you are. It's a little bit allegorical almost. Every character is a caricature.
Yeah.
And it definitely has that vibe. And then it ends up in a place that's like utterly unsatisfying.
Uh-huh.
And I think you're supposed to sort of like wink, wink, nudge, nudge at that. And it's sort of like, aren't we clever for not landing this plane kind of thing?
Yeah.
And so I hadn't thought of it in terms of time capsule, but as I think through all those different elements, I'm like, yeah, those are pretty, pretty millennial traits in terms of how, you know, the people themselves or ourselves, since I'm technically one of them.
Yeah.
And as well as the style of movie making. What was, you said your coworker's name was Chris, is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
What was Chris's take on why it was a millennial movie?
So two things. One was that, like, each character's dreams were grandiose, right? And even their fallbacks were grandiose. Like the Gosling character was like, I want to be an amazing jazz musician. And then his fallback was like, I want to open a super amazing and sexy, like, jazz club. And it struck Chris as like, these are like distinctly millennial sorts of dreams.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely. Kind of working for yourself, being famous. Can I go 30 seconds on La La Land and jazz?
Oh, please. Yeah.
I've probably done this on this show. It might have just been something I yelled at to somebody, yelled about to somebody at one point. But even La La Land's take on jazz is millennial, because I think they treat it like an ironic art form.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing, like, nobody actually likes jazz, but
right,
this one weirdo is really into it.
Yeah.
And and the way they talk, like, their efforts at making him look like a jazz fan are similar to, like, it's like listening to Ronnie try to describe a sports fan.
Yeah, that's true. And,
you know, it sort of has that sports ball vibe to it. And, like, as an actual jazz fan,
I mean,
I wasn't offended, because it's not a moral thing and I'm not that millennial. I was kind of disgusted.
Yeah.
I was like, this is so, what's a word that's not profane? I don't know another way to say half.
Yeah.
We'll go half baked.
Yeah, there you go.
Fill in the blank there. And
there you go.
It was so pathetic. So even that is distinctly millennial, in that they were, it felt like, in retrospect, it felt like a tongue-in-cheek, wink-wink, ironic take on a thing that's actually historical and substantive and a pretty remarkable art form that they did absolutely no justice to whatsoever.
That's really fascinating. I have a thing about that, but I want to say Chris's second thing on millennials first. But I want to get back to that. So his second thing vis-a-vis La La Land being a millennial movie was the whole idea that, like, the characters were so busy, like, gazing at themselves that they couldn't for a moment, like, gaze at each other long enough to make the relationship work. You know what I mean? It was sort of like, it was the motif of, we're two hot people who are ragingly kind of self-obsessed who come together for a moment. So actually the ending of them not being able to make it work due to essentially not being able to sacrifice anything for each other was, I don't know, on one level depressing, but on another level, like, really honest, you know, sure. And really true to who the characters were, I guess. But yeah, that struck him at a kind of very millennial level as well. Yeah. And we're painting with broad brushstrokes here. That isn't, well, obviously, everybody.
The other piece of it that is distinctly millennial is the way that they misrepresented having your dreams fall apart. Mm. So, you know, the Ryan Gosling character wants to be a star jazz musician. Then he ends up doing the sellout thing and joining this pop band.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, being in Nashville and watching people try to chase artistic dreams like that. Yeah, that's how people make money.
Sure.
They do. Yeah. They do sellout stuff, quote, right, unquote, which in reality is just fiscally responsible stuff.
Yeah.
But they don't go from there to start a jazz club. They go from there to working for Edward, you know, what is it? Edward James, and doing like financial advising or something.
Totally.
Like that. Like,
yeah, they become a realtor, you know,
like, they realize I can't have relationships and be on the road all the time. So I'm going to quit that. And right. Yeah, and do realty or do financial advising or,
right,
you know, or become a general contractor,
whatever. Right,
or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
You know, or become a worship leader. And so even that they misrepresented, because they obviously caricaturized the sellout part. And I'm like, okay, that's actually not that far from reality.
Yeah.
But then the move from that to owning a jazz club, I'm like, no, that doesn't happen.
Right.
You go from there to settling into a life where you have fond memories of being on the road. You occasionally, it's like being a former athlete. Sometimes, yeah, you miss it.
That's right.
Most of the time you're like, my life is a little bit better now. And I'm actually able to, like, see kids and love a wife and various, yeah, things that I couldn't do when I was on the road 200 days a year.
See, I would watch a movie about that. Like, that energy is really interesting to me right now. And it kind of has been for over a decade. But yeah, La La Land almost got there. But you're right. To your point, they completely whiffed on it. In the sense that, like, his fallback was still 85% more sexy than what most people have to do. Just to make it in life, you know? Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, you take a swing at being a writer for a decade and a half, and then you kind of end up becoming a college professor, which is great in the sense that, like, I get to talk about the thing that I love. I still get to do it from time to time. But it isn't this sort of, you know, I'm in my little writer's garret in Paris, like, you know, gazing out the window waiting to be inspired, you know? And, yeah, the movie... I think, though, it explains why so many young people love the movie. There's a lot of wish fulfillment in it. You know, you're hot enough and charismatic enough to sort of draw the interest of someone at an equal level. You're pursuing these dreams, all of which are very sexy. I would have loved La La Land if I saw it at 22. In the same way that I loved, you know, whatever the dumb movies were when I was 22, the movies that sort of masqueraded as thoughtful, which is a very kind of 90s motif. It's actually a very Gen X motif, like the whole, like, faux depth thing. I think as Gen Xers,
Dead Poets Society, for example.
Oh my gosh, yes, Dead Poets Society, Fight Club. These are in, like, the fake deep Hall of Fame for me. They're just really stupid things masquerading as smart things. And we did a brisk business in that in the 90s. So I want to go back to your jazz thing. The same director that directed La La Land actually, to me, directed the true and better La La Land a few years previous, and it was the movie Whiplash. Have you seen the movie Whiplash?
No, I haven't. It's on my list of things that I would like to watch. I'm aware of the gist of it. I love the key, you know, is it J.K. Simmons? Is that the
J.K. Simmons, yeah.
Yeah. He's just a sneaky, brilliant actor. No, but I haven't seen it yet. I would like to.
Dude, it's J.K. Simmons and it's Miles Teller from Top Gun Maverick, but yeah. A young Miles Teller. And the premise is, and they're both really broken, flawed characters. Okay, so like just right from the jump, you have two characters that are way more interesting than the two characters in La La Land. So Miles Teller's character wants to become the world's greatest jazz drummer. And he wants this, and you can tell immediately, he wants it to almost a sociopathic degree. Like he's really... It transcends just being thirsty for it. Like he has to have this. And so then he bumps up against this J.K. Simmons character who's sort of the also sociopathic coach, but the sociopathic coach who can unlock all your potential. And at the end you go, was the end worth the means? And in that, it's a really fascinating character study. It's a really interesting study of dreams and ambition and, you know, arriving at the thing that you thought you always wanted and finding it to be another thing entirely. I don't know. I just think it's a really brilliant movie. And yet La La Land is the movie of Damien Chazelle's that everybody has watched and talked about. And I think the previous movie that you're way more of a jazz fan than I am. So you would have to speak to this in a way that I couldn't. But I think the first movie does a lot more justice to the idea of jazz, the idea of being good at jazz. It does more justice to it than La La Land.
Well, I don't think I ever would have watched it as a juxtaposition to La La Land, but now I'm even more intrigued. I will definitely check it out. Yeah, it's striking to hear you describe the outcome of Whiplash, because one of the worst aspects of La La Land is that there was no consequence to their terrible choices.
That's right.
You know, every terrible choice just led them to just diverging paths.
Right.
As opposed to, was the end worth the means?
Yeah, that's it. It
makes me wonder though, is La La Land the creative sellout for Damien What's His Face?
Yeah.
Like, is it sort of a, is it kind of like is he ironically winking at the audience through the whole masquerade of La La Land when his actual good work is the other movie?
So that's a really interesting question, Pipe. And the way that I've heard the story told is actually the inverse of what you just said. Like, essentially, Whiplash was the sort of short film that became a low budget, kind of indie film darling that put Chazelle on the map so that he could make La La Land, which doesn't make sense because Whiplash is the much better movie. So apparently there was something really meaningful for him in La La Land. Although to your point, there were no consequences for the characters. The only consequence was they didn't get to be together. But like any sort of adult viewing of the movie would suggest that they weren't going to make it anyway. Like even if they had ended up together in the third act, you gave it like 6 months tops, you know, because we've all known relationships like that. I mean, it's why in Nashville, and you speak to this as a Nashville resident, I'd be interested to hear you on this. I feel like in Nashville, the only couples that make it are the couples where there's a super self-centered kind of poncy artistic one. That person always has to be paired with sort of a grounded normal person in order for the relationship to work. But if you have two super poncy, self-obsessed, fame-chasing, performative people in a relationship, it almost never works. And that's what we were working with in La La Land. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, as a caricature, it's pretty accurate. Yeah, there's I know a lot of musicians who, or the other option is there's fame chasing and whatever, and then there's what I described earlier where the cost becomes not worth it and they step away. Yeah. And so you meet a couple who's just standard middle class suburban or whatever.
Yeah,
they've got, you know, a kid in first grade and a kid in third grade. And you come to find out as you get to know them, like, oh, you used to tour as the drummer for X.
Yeah.
Or, oh, you were a session guitar player who's played on all these albums or whatever it is. Yeah. And yeah, the key ingredient is that somebody anchors this thing in realism and humility.
Yeah.
And so if somebody is still maintaining that sort of fame chasing whatever,
yeah,
the other person must counterbalance them, or they counterbalance themselves where they do that for a while and they step away. But you don't see very many, like the glamour couples are fireworks, you know, they're bright, they're glittery, and then they're gone in a puff of smoke.
So the first type of person you described, I think, is actually the type of person that I'm the most interested in right now, in that, like, being the session guitarist for whomever, or being the touring drummer for whomever, that's really impressive. And like, the more I've been around and like trying to be a writer for the last 25 years, and you know this too, because you've done it, you know how hard it is to make it at all at any level. So like, ascending to a level where you were the, you know, the touring drummer for whomever, like, that's a really huge deal. But then kind of having the dignity and the sort of self-sacrificial gene to the degree that you can step away from it and go, it's more important that I see my kids grow up, or it's more important that I provide some sort of a stable life for my family. I really find that respectable. Like, I'm really drawn to that kind of person. And it's almost more ridiculous to meet somebody in late middle age who's still so thirsty for the fame. There seems to be almost something developmental about it that didn't work, you know?
A lot of this, I mean, obviously the world that I inhabit is very Christian, you know?
Yeah.
I work at a church, the majority of my circle, closer circle, are Christians. And so but what's telling about that is that the people who I'm aware of who have done this well have been rooted in a Christian identity. And so their values are weighed very differently. And almost without exception, what they say is they look at the older guys or women, these usually guys, who are still these touring musicians in their late 40s, their 50s, they're on their third marriage. They often have substance abuse habits. They're dealing with depression. They're whatever. And it's basically an addiction to that kind of work.
Yeah.
And so at 30, they looked at those guys and were like, I do not want that life. And so there's, but they see it differently because they're not just seeing possibilities. They're looking at cost in light of Christian values, you know, humility and family and faithfulness and you know, availability to your church and community and whatever.
Right. Yeah.
And so Christianity, like the Christian solidity, makes a massive difference in this, because otherwise when people step off the road, it's not with humility. It's more out of like, fine, I guess I have to do this. And so there's almost like resentment. There's that pining away.
Yes.
And the guys who I know who have done it, they don't pine away. They have fond memories. So they talk about being on the road the way I talk about high school football.
Right.
It is a past era. It was a blast. There's no possibility of going back.
Yeah.
And, but man, fun stories to tell, really good experiences. Had a great time doing it, those kinds of things.
Yeah, man, that's so good. And it's such a good word. And it's such a good reminder that whatever our dreams and aspirations are, like, it's not bad to have them. But as we grow in the Lord, as we grow in sanctification, as you know, the Holy Spirit is changing our hearts and our desires, like our life is going to look different, and it actually should look different. And, you know, for every kind of unicornish person that the Lord, you know, calls to a more public life and who the Lord allows to have some measure of fame or platform or whatever, you know, there are probably 50 of us who shouldn't have that. And our lives become exercises in appreciating the good things that the Lord has given us that aren't our dreams. And that can actually be really rich if you allow it to be. Which is a good note to end on my birthday, Pipe. Maybe I'm just preaching to myself at this point. But this was really fun, man. We should close it, and then we should tape a Patreon, and in between, I'll tell the funny publishing story. Pipe, we've done what we always do in this program, in that we've wandered to and fro throughout a couple of topics, and until next time.
We want to take a moment to thank the team at Life Audio for partnering with us on this podcast. Be sure to go to lifeaudio.com and take a look at the other podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
Hey, Ted, what do you want to do today?
Well, Ashley, I've always got work to do, naps to take, but I have a better idea. How about we invite everyone to listen to the Team Us podcast?
I love that idea. Let's do it right now. Hi, everyone. We're Ted and Ashley Slater, and we'd love for you to join us as we talk about teamwork in marriage.
We share how grace, commitment, and cooperation can help couples live the everyday moments of marriage together.
To listen, go to lifeaudio.com and search for Team Us.